I feel that I'm oftentimes curious about something. It's something I need to interrogate within myself. Sometimes it begins with a sound or music or image. Sometimes it's literally, it's a feeling and like, what is this that I can't name? And I begin there. And, you know, it's very rarely an idea as much as it's like a bodily sensation or an image or a sound or something that's entering through the ear or the eye. And that's when I start to go, okay, what is this, you know, what is this obstacle kind of, you know, or what is this thing that I'm curious about? And then as I can kind of go into it, I start to find the music in it. And so that's, it's being interrogated, not just by the questioning of language, but also the questioning that space and breath allows, that poetry offers, right? That anytime you have the caesura or the line break or the stanza break, all of that is going to offer that breath. And so I think that one of the reasons I love poetry, and it allows me to kind of figure out something or deeply question something, is because it allows space for breath and because it allows space for an unknowing and mystery, as opposed to I'm going to sit down and I'm going to solve this thing. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to name it and therefore be healed. I think instead it's like, oh, what I'm going to understand is that this is what it is to be human. This is what it is to be complex, to have capacity for many things, to be able to both absorb and release in the same space of a page. And that is really interesting to me because it feels like instead of creating something that sort of wraps things up or is sort of like, oh, this is going to be some sort of beautiful gem that makes us all feel good, I'm much more interested in what it is to have that mystery take place within there and have that sense of unknowing, have that sense of solace in the making and in the mess, as opposed to in the answers.
Hey, poetry is to me the prince of the literary arts, you know? It's at the very top because it's language refined to its apex of memorability. And so I'm interested in poetry as memorability and poetry as something you live by. These are the words you live by. These words stay in your brain and guide your life. That's what I'm interested in.
It'll be better for me if I could read you just the beginning of the first essay in the book, actually, by Daniel Black. It's called Rhythm in Writing. I've always loved the rhythm of Black vernacular. It's in the preacher's hoop, Black women's talk at kitchen tables, Black men's guttural laughter in barbershops, the sway and clapping of the Black church choir. We are a people who move and have our being in metered time. There's no secret. Writers and scholars have documented this phenomenon since the 1960s. What is elusive is how to capture this pace, this cadence on paper. It's not simply an issue of writing in Ebonics. Rather, it's the ability to seize the reader's consciousness and move it in musical time. That, my friend, is a literary craft, a stylistic device that is hell to master. But it's not impossible. Some Black writers are known for it. Morrison comes to mind, as do John Edgar Wideman and Sonia Sanchez. Indeed, the 1960s Black arts writers germinated in a time and space where the aesthetic emphasis centered around Black pathos. In other words, these writers meant to translate the beauty of Black idiomatic expression into literary artistic production, and this is the creative achievement contemporary Black writers inherit. However, mimicking it is another story. It seems the first secret is in the consciousness of word choice.
Well, yes, my memoir / autofiction is called Borges and Me. And as you know, it's a story of my time in 1970 when my best friend Billy was drafted for the Vietnam War, and so was I. So he went to Vietnam and I went to Scotland to hide out and to do my graduate work. Altogether, I spent nearly 7 years in Scotland. And so it was during that time that Billy was killed in Vietnam. And I was a nervous wreck. My memoir talks about my depression, my anxieties. And then I, through my friend Alistair Reed, I met the great Argentine writer Borges. And we went on a little road trip through the highlands. And this conversation with Borges really restored me back to myself and what was important in life.
Writers are often taught, and rightly so, The Craft of Language Economy, the use of as few words as possible to convey a point. And generally, this makes for a smoother style and less laborious text. However, sometimes, in order to establish a Black rhythmic pulse in written discourse, one needs more words, more instruments with which to play the symphonic complexity of Black life. There's something in those essays from the past that says, in order to make what you make, you have to use what you have. You have to submerge yourself, immerse yourself in what you know, in your own vernacular, in your own tone, in your own belief, in your own way of doing things and telling stories. And that's how the writing can get done. And there's something about that moment that I just read from Daniel Black that seems to say, make use of your own vernacular, even if it does not necessarily follow what you're taught in your MFA classroom. How do you create a specificity of voice, a specificity of character? And sometimes that has to do with using what you know. So you're afraid to change because you don't want people to call you strange. So I sort of get that, but I grew up in a very different situation. I'm actually always surprised that I'm even in communication with my parents at all. I didn't think anybody in my family would want to have anything to do with me because that was the message I got from the world when I was a kid, that people do not want to have anything to do with queer people other than queer people. That was what I understood, that queer people themselves didn't even want to have anything to do with one another. And so I was putting myself in training, you know, from the age when I figured out that I was into guys, which was very young when I was in elementary school. I was in training for the day I leave my parents' house, they find out I'm gay and never speak to me again. Now, that's not how things went. But if you have that idea, if you already have the idea that everyone in your life is going to reject you, then that makes it easier to write. You know, because you don't think you have anything to lose. And part of our fear about writing that which is intimate or personal or traumatic has to do with the fact that we are afraid that, yeah, I'll have the good piece of writing, but I lose this really wonderful relationship in my real life. And I don't want to lose my relationships. Moving forward in time, I think it's different for me now, and I think it's easier for me to write into a kind of risk because I have trained myself to a point where I don't think about that risk as I am writing. I put myself in a position where I only have to think about that risk once I am at a point in a draft. And by that time, the poem is so good, I don't care about that relationship. But in the beginning, as I was saying to Mia earlier, my goal is lines. Oh, that sounds good. Oh, that sounds good. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, I might be able to use this piece. You take things down to the word, to the fragment, to the line, in some cases to the sentence, to the paragraph, and you start putting things together. Then you can begin to put them together because they go together, not because they're about you in any particular way.
There are chapters like David Simon where something happens by himself and then it's subject to a completely other inquiry, which happens. In David Simon's case, there was this wonderful phrase called the bounce that came up, which is how creativity works, the way a ball might bounce in a group. It bounces from one person to another and then they bounce it back and it achieves more velocity when more hands are on it. And the bounce has a life of its own. I absolutely related to that. As a creator, the bounce in one's own brain was the trickiest aspect. I could have written a whole book about collaboration.
So the whole power of the state is geared towards dividing and conquering, whether it's domestically within a state, whether it's exercising its power overseas and things like colonization, which is all about dividing and conquering. So in the face of that, to engage in expansive solidarity and capacious grief is to work against the mechanisms of colonialism and militarism and the state. It's enormously difficult, which is why it has to be rebuilt from every generation, because every generation is subject to the power of the state and its ideologies and its mythologies and so on. So I think the lessons that I've extracted from that in this book, To Save and to Destroy, where I talk about expansive solidarity and capacious grief, these are lessons that, again, have been learned by other people before me, but lessons that I had to learn for myself and to put into my own words. So as a writer, I do believe that art and literature in and of themselves are important. One of the most important reasons why is because language is crucial. Part of the way that states and authoritarian regimes exercise their power is not just through physical violence and intimidation, but through a maltreatment of language itself. I mean, Trump is a perfect example of this. Everything that comes out of his mouth in terms of language is horrifying for anybody who has any sensitivity to language. You know, the excesses of his language in terms of insults, in terms of hyperbolic praise for his sycophants and so on. It's a perfect example of how language is used by an authoritarian and by the state in order to obfuscate reality and in order to intimidate people. That language is ugly from my perspective. And so there is something about being committed to literature and to art that awakens us to the importance of beauty. And I think about what John Keats, the poet, said, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. You can't separate these kinds of things. So if you're committed to the beauty of language, you're also committed to this idea that language has a relationship to truth. And you can see that authoritarians don't have a relationship to truth. They have a relationship to the abuse of truth because language is one of the most crucial ways that authoritarianism extends its power. What I've discovered as a writer is that fear is a good indicator that there is a truth. To speak the truth in a society is oftentimes an act that requires some courage.
It really has always stuck with me about what that means to write about your identity in the acceptable way, in the right way, what's getting it wrong, what's getting it right. And I think that one of the biggest things is that I really want to make sure that I give myself the grace and the freedom to be who I am in my entirety, which is also the white parts of me. It's also the Mexican parts of me. It's also, you know, it's the fact that both Spanish and English are colonizer language. It's the fact that, you know, I have a tribe in Mexico, but I don't have any, you know, connections with them. But my grandfather was part of the Purépecha tribe. You know, all of these things that I would love as I write, like those things come up. But I'm always very careful, I think, who am I writing this for? Because I want to write it for me. Like I want to write to become free on the page and to really be my most authentic self and bring my whole self to it. I don't want to write as a way of performance or a way of offering someone an identity that feels like, oh, that's exactly what I thought. And now I feel like I can like eat it like a fruit. And now I'm replenished because I know who you are. You know, and it's like, the truth is like my fruit is very complicated and it might not satiate you and it might burn a little and it might be sweet and it might also be disgusting and it might also like, you know, not be for you at all, you know? And so I think that there is a real consideration that we have to explore when anyone is writing about their, what identity means. And a lot of that is like, who are you writing it for? Why are you writing it? And are you doing it in a way that for you feels like a truth? And that I come back to that all the time because I don't want to do it for somebody else, no matter who that person is, right? Even as I spoke about my beloved grandfather who's since passed, even if I'm writing something that's solely for him, that's not going to feel right to me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.